Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. To learn more about Allowed and how you can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The program you're about to hear from the Allowed Archives was produced in 2007. Very pleased to welcome John Sullivan, the chief executive for Atlantic Media, who is going to introduce Robert Vair, the editor of the anthology, The American Idea, and in turn, Mr. Vair will introduce our distinguished panelists, George McGovern, Walter Kern, and James Q. Wilson. Please welcome John Sullivan.
Welcome all. Thank you for joining us tonight. It's a privilege to be up here before so many of you who, by your very presence, are honoring the written word and to some extent the Atlantic Monthly, which has been publishing only for 150 years. We've got a few more to go. You as readers know that the Atlantic has attracted the most revered and writers and thinkers of the last century and a half. And Atlantic has also posted, I think, a pretty impressive record of finding young talent whose fame came after they appeared in the magazine. This particular book that we've done, The American Idea, represents the very best of Atlantic's work over the last 150 years, from the writers and thinkers who have shaped our history and in many ways tell the story of America, who we are, where we have come from, and where we are going. This anthology is not only the work of the original writers who have appeared in the magazine, but also of Robert Vair, who's the editor-at-large for Atlantic and who's going to moderate the panel. Robert is one who's respected for selecting the material and editing this book, which is no small task when you have so much to choose from. Robert himself has his own sort of special contribution to the book, with a series of introductory sort of setups or commentaries which precede each selection. These headnotes, as they're called, provide historical background, personal anecdotes, and sort of insight into each of the pieces. And they themselves, I think, are a work of art. So we're really indebted to Robert for doing this. One last thing. This is a book. We publish a magazine. But Atlantic is also recreating in many ways the energy of 150 years ago with a very vibrant website, which I encourage you to go to if you have not already, where once again some of the most talented writers such as Jim Fallows or Andrew Sullivan are doing daily blogs, and also a whole group cluster of four or five young folks who are not yet quite so famous, but who are extraordinary talents and themselves sort of creating the American voice. So with that, thank you all very much, and let me turn it over to Robert. And folks, you want to come on out?
Thank you very much, John. Good evening, everyone, and very nice to see you all. We're here tonight to celebrate not just the publication of a new book, but also the 150th anniversary of a genuine American publishing institution. The Atlantic Monthly cannot lay claim to being the oldest magazine in the United States. Scientific American, Town and Country, and Harper's were all founded just a few years earlier. And yet, at the ripe old age of 150, the Atlantic does have the right to call itself America's oldest continuously published general interest magazine. By any standard, a sesquicentennial is a remarkable achievement, especially in a notoriously fragile sector of the publishing world, where the average life expectancy of a new magazine is closer to 150 days, not 150 years. How can we account for the Atlantic's astonishing longevity? I wish I had a simple soundbite answer. But when you look at the history of the magazine, three plausible explanations do seem to come front and center. First, the Atlantic has been fortunate to have, right from the start, a series of strong and devoted stewards on both the editorial and business sides. The fact that the magazine has had only 14 editors-in-chief in 15 decades is just one indication of the inherent stability of the institution. A second factor would have to be the Atlantic's unusual genealogical tree. Some of you may know the magazine was founded by an illustrious group who represented some of the towering figures of 19th century American intellectual life. There was Ralph Waldo Emerson and Oliver Wendell Holmes and Henry Wadsworth Longfellow and James Russell Lowell. At the time of the magazine's founding in 1857, these were the golden boys of American literature, philosophy, and science, and they set an unusually high standard for their successors to live up to. Finally, I would point to a few words in the brief mission statement that the founders published in the magazine's very first issue. Almost buried within these few quiet sentences sketching out editorial goals and policies was an assertion that the magazine would be primarily dedicated to monitoring, exploring, and advancing the cause of something the founders called the American idea. Exactly what they meant by that term they never made clear, either in their mission statement or anywhere else in their public utterances or private journals. But, you know, we can make some educated guesses about what they were talking about. They could have been talking about political democracy or personal freedom or social justice or economic progress. All of these values were, after all, enumerated in the Declaration of Independence. And yet, it's intriguing and also a little mystifying that the founders would give such weight to a term that does not appear to have had it to have been in common use at the time. In retrospect, they seem to have had a certain confidence that their readers would know instinctively what they had in mind. Because even if the term the American idea was not part of the language of the mid-1850s, concerns about national identity were very much on the minds of many Americans. Waves of westward expansion had fired up nationalistic sentiments, setting off a groundswell of support for a stronger federal government to replace this kind of loose, decentralized confederation of states that had been in place for decades. At the same time, antagonisms between the North and the South were intensifying over widening economic disparity and, of course, over the corrosive issue of slavery. The collision of these two powerful forces would soon lead to the Civil War, 4 years of almost unimaginable carnage that would tear the country apart. The Atlantic Monthly was born into a world in which the very idea of America seemed imperiled. But by evoking that simple three-word phrase, the American idea, the founders managed to give their magazine both an identity and a calling. On some elemental level, they were making an implicit promise to their readers that the Atlantic would be taking on the large and perennially relevant questions of our national life. What does it mean to be an American? What constitutes the national interest? And what should America's role in the world be? The anthology we're here to talk about tonight takes its title, its central theme, and its animating spirit from this important, if very elusive, phrase. From the beginning, I wanted this anthology to be more than a greatest hits collection. My overriding hope is that the book does in the end provide a really unique window on American history by reflecting how the magazine has consistently over the years set its sights on the fundamental subjects of the American experience, like war and peace, science and religion, the problem of race, the role of women, the plight of the cities, the struggle to preserve the environment, the strengths and failings of our politics, and especially the changing character of our country and our country's changing relations with the world. This preoccupation, it seems to me, is at the core of who we are as a magazine, a major part of our genetic heritage. It connects our labors with the work of the founders and with all the other Atlantic contributors over the course of its history. In very different ways, that mission informs the work of each of the writers whose articles in the anthology we honor here tonight, which brings me to our first distinguished contributor, who will be James Q. Wilson. In late 1993, when former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani hired William Bratton to run his police department, violent crime in the city was near an all-time high at some 2,400 murders recorded that year. By the end of the decade, violent crime had plunged to its lowest point in 35 years, with a total number of recorded murders at somewhere close to 900. A number of possible explanations for this spectacular turnaround have been offered up over the years. The decline of crack cocaine abuse, significant drops in the unemployment rate, even the demographic consequences of legalized abortion. But many criminologists, as well as Giuliani and Bratton themselves, contend that the city's radically improved crime picture emanated directly from the ideas expressed in a groundbreaking Atlantic essay called Broken Windows by James Q. Wilson and George L. Kelling. Wilson, who was then a professor of government at Harvard, and Kelling, a professor of criminology at Rutgers, teamed up to write their article out of a deep concern about the shifting role of the police from crime preventers to crime solvers, from maintaining law and order in the streets to investigating crimes that had already been committed. They argued that this crucial metamorphosis in police responsibility, which had begun in the 1960s, contradicted what social scientists had long observed about the dangerous effects unleashed when society tacitly accepts even minor crimes, such as aggressive panhandling and graffiti. They quickly proliferate into major ones. Quote, social psychologists and police officers tend to agree that if a window in a building is broken and is left unrepaired, all the rest of the windows will soon be broken, unquote, Wilson and Kelling observed, adding that, quote, serious street crime flourishes in areas in which disorderly behavior goes unchecked. Under the rubric of community policing and zero tolerance, Wilson and Kelling's crime-fighting prescriptions have been successfully adopted not only by New York City, but by police departments all over the country, including right here in Los Angeles and in Boston and Denver and many other places. And I quote from a 2004 article in the Chronicle of Higher Education, which said, if there were a hall of fame for influential policy ideas, then the broken windows thesis would probably have its own exhibit. We're delighted to have broken windows in the anthology and equally delighted to have James Q. Wilson with us here tonight.
Thank you, Mr. Vair. It is a great honor to be here celebrating this magazine's 150th anniversary. When it was founded, police departments in the United States had just barely come into being. They were being organized really for the first time on a semi-professional basis. And their first task was not to solve crimes. Their first task was to preserve public order. If you contemplate public order from the perspective of someone who believes, as I do, deeply in the American idea of personal freedom and constitutional liberty, it creates a puzzle. Public order can mean jackboots. It can mean stormtroopers. It can mean tyrannical rule. Or it can mean the moderate management of those behaviors in public places which most people find objectionable, which they find it hard to ignore, but which they hope the authorities, or better yet, the common culture can manage on their behalf. Trying to define public order in a way that preserves personal liberty while still instilling in large cities a sense of community and continuity was the central assumption of police departments as they began their lives in the 1850s. By 1960, as Mr. Vare said, this had become replaced by a concern for solving crimes. And with radios and eventually with a 911 call, police departments were committed to the idea of responding quickly to people who had suffered a robbery, a burglary, or an assault. Important as these things were, they pushed into the background the problem of public order. When Kelling and I wrote our piece 25 years ago, almost this month, we were drawing on the experience that Kelling had supervised in Newark, New Jersey, where an organization called the Police Foundation, on whose board I served and for which Kelling worked, had begun an experiment, randomly selecting certain precincts in which foot patrol officers were assigned and other precincts in which they were not assigned. It was a classic social science thing, trying to figure out what difference this intervention made. Police officers with whom we spoke confidently predicted that having officers on foot patrol would not affect the crime rate. And they were exactly right. It didn't. But to our astonishment, the public in those precincts where the police officers were walking on foot were absolutely delighted. So Kelling and others began interviewing them to find out why they were delighted. They were delighted because an officer on foot made sure that an aggressive panhandler did not approach a woman waiting with her shopping cart on a bus stop. It made sure that people drinking in public places concealed their drinks or, better yet, moved away. They made sure that teenagers gathering on a street corner did not become hostile. And they did most of these things without making any arrests at all, simply telling people to move along or get on with their affairs. And the public loved this. So we wrote this article, Broken Windows, in order to explain that public order ought once again to become a dominant feature of municipal policing. And over the 25 years that have ensued, the concern for public order has, given the limits of the resources we now devote to policing, a major concern, first in New York and then in many other places. We believe that a commitment to public order, democratically understood, that is to say, a cohesive, non-threatening way of making sure that public places are those that ordinary people will enjoy, is demonstrably valuable. To state it is to believe it. The larger question is, would public order, if maintained, reduce the crime rate? Now, Mayor Giuliani and now Commissioner Bratton have given me and Kelling a lot of credit for having offered an idea that made a difference. I'd like to hope that was true, but I can't be sure it's true. It's a controversial idea, and there are social scientists who deny that it had any impact. And the evidence, the clear evidence, really isn't in. But there have been some straws in the wind. A professor at the John F. Kennedy School at Harvard went to Jersey City and tried in randomly selected precincts to install public order and compared the effect on the crime rate in those precincts with the effect on the crime rate of doing nothing about public order in the same city. And this professor and his colleagues discovered that when you emphasize public order, the level of crime declined. And it declined because with public order, more ordinary citizens use the streets. And when ordinary citizens use the streets, they take the space that otherwise would be reserved for rowdy teenagers, aggressive panhandlers, graffiti artists, street-walking prostitutes. And as these people are displaced by ordinary people, they go elsewhere to do what? We're not quite certain. But the space in which they once carried on their business now becomes less crime-prone. Now, to be fair, there are arguments done by social scientists that are on the opposite side of this issue. I would love to see the experiment done in Jersey City replicated in Los Angeles or New York or Boston, but persuading officials to conduct a social science experiment when their main job is to, besides holding on to their jobs, address the concerns of the public as expressed in an everyday basis is not an optimistic scenario. But we keep hoping that this test will be continued. It is our belief, Kelling's and mine, that public order has been produced by this, that it is a decent level of public order, and that we think the evidence suggests that public order will in fact reduce the crime rate. This is part of the American idea. Alexis de Tocqueville in 1835, just 15 years before the Atlantic started, published Democracy in America, where he commented on the individualism of the American culture. It was an individualistic culture, and he credited it for producing a concern for liberty and equality, but he also worried that individualism would break apart the normal cultural constraints of the aristocratic societies with which he was so familiar in France. It was a genuine concern, but it seems to me that a proper approach to the problem of public order can mean that individualism survives and prospers while decency also spreads. Thank you very much.
We're going to shift gears a little bit from crime on the streets to pretty well-known American Warren Buffett. With the possible exception of J.P. Morgan, Warren Buffett is the most successful investor in United States history. Through his company, Berkshire Hathaway, Buffett has turned tens of thousands of working stiffs, i.e. his shareholders, into multimillionaires, and himself into the second wealthiest man in the world after Bill Gates, with a net worth of $52 billion and counting. But as the critic and novelist Walter Kern pointed out in a brilliant 2004 Atlantic essay on the so-called Oracle of Omaha, Buffett ought to be prized as much as a cultural icon as a financial one. For Walter Kern, the author of Up in the Air and several other very acclaimed idiosyncratic novels, Buffett's second great talent, rarely if ever commented upon despite all the media attention, is verbal. Buffett's speeches and public utterances, which are a mix of one-liners, unconventional folk wisdom, and plain-spoken truths, hark back to Mark Twain, Will Rogers, and other legendary American communicators, many of them, like Buffett, sons of the American heartland. In this essay, which is called American Everyman, Walter Kern, who grew up in rural Minnesota, not far geographically or psychically from Berkshire Hathaway's Nebraska headquarters, explored Buffett's mastery of the American idiom via a close reading of the financier's literary works as represented by these much-anticipated letters to shareholders that Buffett writes every year in his annual reports. Pouring over 20 years' worth of the wit and wisdom of Warren Buffett with the punctiliousness of a Dead Sea Scrolls scholar, Walter discovered barely concealed behind a scrim of very formulaic businessman's prose, what he describes as, quote, a conscious, sophisticated performer, the inventor and caretaker of a rare persona that has no equivalent in American business. It's great to have Walter here, Walter Kern here tonight.
Thank you. Well, I feel a little bit like one of those monkeys they would send up on space missions compared to two real astronauts sitting beside me. I'm nothing but a freelance writer, and I have on my left the man who arguably made New York real estate so expensive due to the improvement in its quality of life that when I left in 1990, before his ideas had been imposed on the streets of New York, I was thinking it would be just a few years before I got back from Montana and things had really plunged and I'd have a cheap apartment. Instead, thanks to him, prices tripled and I was never able to reside again in New York City economically. On my right is a hero of mine, personally, the first the first presidential candidate to both appeal to the idealism of my 10-year-old self. And it was possible to have idealism as a 10-year-old in 1972. That's what the odd thing was. And as a rural Minnesotan, I recognized in Senator McGovern a man from our part of the country who sounded like we did, who during a very confusing time to be a child, which I can imagine is only less confusing. I mean, it might be as bad now, actually. offered a vision that was so simple and so much a part of that part of the country and what seemed to me the decency of that part of the country that I believe we may have almost won a majority for you in Minnesota that year. I don't know that we did, but so here I am, just a writer, and here I am with a subject, Warren Buffett, a man who never sought consciously to do anything for anyone really but himself. Get rich. You know, this is a book full of the stories of people who, you know, sought to alleviate poverty, sought to raise the consciousness of the American public, Martin Luther King, Senator McGovern, and Oliver Wendell Holmes. That I'm in this book still makes absolutely no sense to me. And that Warren Buffett's in this book in a way makes no sense, because what he did, if you'd think about it, was set out to aggrandize himself, make a lot of money for himself, at first his family, then his friends. But he ended up becoming a character that I believe belongs with some of these other social reformers and sort of visionary and progressive types, because he represented, and as I studied him, he came to represent even more, all that we can be proud of about capitalism. There's plenty we can't be, but his sense of patience, probity, sort of stalwart common sense, his ability to communicate to everyone that they possessed the basic principles necessary to succeed under this system is kind of unprecedented. Warren Buffett brought capitalism, the story is called American Everyman, finally to the level of the people, even though he was less like the rest of us than any individual I can imagine in terms of his net worth. That is a huge accomplishment. If you think about J.P. Morgan or the 19th century robber barons, they basically founded their fortunes on the destruction of American labor wholesale in their mines, railroads, and so on. If you think about the people who got rich in the 20s, they were, at the time, considered geniuses of the market, and during the Depression, great swindlers who'd bankrupted the country. If you think about the fortunes that were founded after the war, they were great faceless corporate fortunes that seemed to have to do with the conformism and depletion of the human spirit. No one really idolizes the technocrats who made General Motors or General Electric, except themselves, in their self-titled books, How I Did It. Warren Buffett, though, has not written Art of the Deal book about himself with his own face on the cover. He's unique in both his modesty as a self-promoter and in his arrogance as a financial mind. He knew before the dot-com bust that it was a bunch of baloney and was willing to tell anyone who was willing to listen to him. His own stock, which represents the aggregation of his many companies that he owns, which are an almost surreal collection of everyday companies that neither you nor I would consider hot tips. Fruit of the Loom underwear, Dairy Queen, Justin Boots. Who knew that anybody was still making money making cowboy boots but Warren Buffett? And through his patient collection of these very sort of humble companies, through the fact that he didn't sell, that he rode out the storms, that he, with the sort of Midwestern, impassive, stoic, skeptical point of view towards the ups and downs of everyday life, knew that things will generally get better slowly, if people do their jobs and save their money, and we'll always need underwear. I think Gillette Razors was another of his. He looked around at the room and said, what do I need to use every day? And then he bought the companies that made them. So anyway, I'll just read you briefly from this, because the reason I think that this was a social enterprise and not just an individual one can be encapsulated in a little story from my small town in Minnesota. I had a neighbor who, an older man who had six children. His sixth child was autistic. He was very concerned about her future. It was clear when she was about 3 or 4 years old that she might not have a very easy passage through life. And hoping to sort of secure a bit of a future for her, he bought a few shares of a company called Berkshire Hathaway that he'd heard about from friends, and whose stock price in those days, this being, let's see, the early 70s, was probably, I don't know, in the high hundreds of dollars. It's a stock that never splits, so it goes up and up. Well, this young woman now, about 40, is worth approximately $40 million. Due to the fact that that stock price is now about $80,000 or perhaps over $90,000 a share. So the wealth that Warren Buffett aggregated to himself was also shared in a sort of form of socialistic capitalism in a way that is almost unprecedented. He made more people rich, getting rich himself, than many people I can think of, and seemed to have a great time doing it. I'll just read a quick paragraph or two and move on here, because as I say, as the monkey in the spacecraft here, I have little right to read anything. There is a line of self-made, iconoclastic, pragmatic, larger-than-life American everyman that begins in the popular mind with Benjamin Franklin and runs through Mark Twain, Will Rogers, and Harry Truman, but also shows up in such far-flung characters as Walt Whitman, Henry Ford, and Ernest Hemingway. They are the fresh air paragons of democratic self-invention, the anti-phonies who tell it like it is, and with their grassroots words and ways rebuke the pretentious sophistication of Europeanized elites. Warren Buffett, as much as anyone else alive right now, belongs to this indispensable tradition of truth-telling Americans, so square and forthright that they end up seeming subversive. his true identity, the stuff about him that can be discovered by interviewing his family and associates or digging through his garbage, doesn't really matter, finally, compared with the reputation he has created. Fear is the foe of the fattest, he wrote in his 1994 Berkshire Hathaway report. One of the things I said in the article was that the thing I admired most, perhaps, of all, was that he'd never written one of these Trump-like books with himself on the cover, you know, as Jack Welch has or Donald Trump. But he basically created his oeuvre through a form of junk mail, which is the corporate report. These are the only corporate reports I know of in America that probably are opened more often than thrown away. Anyway, this is the soul of the Buffett program. Stay cool. Exploit the follies of the crowd. It's the oldest investment advice there is, but Buffett has personalized it over the years by showing a certain contempt for the financial markets themselves, which he likes to portray as dens of waste and vanity rather than basically efficient systems for allotting capital. It's one of the reasons he's adored. He treats his shareholders as fellow members of a morally solid, wised-up in-crowd surrounded by ethically wayward, crazy people. It's us against them, the sane versus the mad, the prudent versus the greedy. And it's our right, perhaps even our duty, to grab the money from their trembling, sweaty hands. Thank you.
Thank you, Walter. Like many politicians of the Cold War era, George McGovern, a decorated World War II bomber pilot who was first elected to the United States Senate as a Democrat from South Dakota in 1963, abhorred the anti-democratic precepts of communism. Yet Senator McGovern was equally dismayed by the ways in which anti-communist zealotry seemed to have hijacked U.S. foreign policy. In an incisive essay, 1967 essay for The Atlantic called America's Crisis Addiction, McGovern argued that the country's ongoing obsession with communism had created a mindset of paranoia and hyperreaction in Washington that had led to a series of American military interventions of dubious relevance to the national interest, most notably and disastrously in Vietnam. Another calamitous consequence of these Cold War attitudes, McGovern contended, is that it detracted national attention and resources from America's own urgent social problems, among them deteriorating schools, declining health care, a faltering economy, and escalating racial tensions. In a line that would reverberate for years, Senator McGovern asked, "How will the world see us if we succeed in pacifying Vietnam but fail to pacify Chicago?" McGovern was relatively unknown at the time he wrote his Atlantic essay, but in 1968, as American deaths in Vietnam rose dramatically and race riots tore apart the nation's cities, the quiet-mannered senator began to emerge from obscurity. And by the time of the infamous Democratic convention in Chicago, he had become inarguably the most respected anti-war politician in the country. 4 years later, with the war still raging, he reached the pinnacle of his influence when he won his party's nomination to challenge the incumbent president, Richard Nixon, only to suffer one of the most lopsided electoral defeats in American political history. Of course, we now know that this election result was far less a reflection on Senator McGovern's candidacy than it was the result of illegal and unethical campaign tactics used against him. It is an honor to have Senator McGovern's essay in our anthology, and it is an honor to have him here with us tonight.
So thank you very much. I want to express my own personal appreciation to the Atlantic Monthly for having the wit and wisdom to put together this compilation of pieces over the last 150 years. Mr. Kern, in a kind of a self-denigrating opening, paid great respect to Professor Wilson and me, but it occurred to me that when he likened himself to those monkeys that went into outer space before the human beings did, that was quite an achievement. I'm glad I didn't have to do that. So he also had a flashing wit, which we saw before the program, when he picked up this book that the Atlantic Monthly has put out with all these pieces going back to 1857, and he said, looking at it, well, any book that includes me as one of the authors along with Mark Twain and Albert Einstein is probably a book I'll buy. I feel the same way. I'm just going to read a couple of lines, a few sentences from my essay that was written in January of 1967. It's hard for me to believe that was more than 40 years ago. I was a freshman senator at that time. Vietnam was at its height, or its depth, depending on what's the accurate word. We were having trouble with Cuba and with China and other places. But let me just read a few sentences to give you the flavor of this. In his Crisis Papers of the American Revolution, Thomas Paine observed, "'Tis surprising to see how rapidly a panic will sometimes run through a country." There's a disturbing American tendency, and this may not be peculiar to Americans, it may be a characteristic of dominant powers at the height of their glory, but a disturbing tendency to overreact to certain ideological and military factors while overlooking issues of vastly greater relevance to our safety and well-being. A civil insurrection in Santo Domingo or Vietnam is dramatic, but what is its significance compared with such quiet challenges as the proliferation of nuclear weapons, the surging of nationalism, and social upheavals in the developing world, or the mounting crisis of hunger and population? What I was generally concerned with is not only the exaggerated anti-communism, which both political parties pursued, sometimes in a contest as to which one would appear the most belligerent, the toughest, the most military inclined in dealing with the presence of certain communist states around the world. But I worried about the exaggerated nature of those threats as they were perceived. And I concluded this essay with a quote from one of the earlier contributors, Ralph Waldo Emerson. Let me just read the final paragraph of my essay. "America has achieved a position of power and influence in the world that is unprecedented. We have often used that power generously and courageously perhaps more than any other nation of our age. I have no doubt of our capacity to respond effectively to a genuine crisis that calls for vigorous and decisive action. I should like to believe that we will also develop a talent for discovering and responding rationally to the underlying forces at work in our time. But to those innumerable tensions, struggles, and incidents of the future that we neither can nor should control, I hope we will manifest a measure of Ralph Waldo Emerson's wisdom, quote, "Let him not quit his belief that a pop gun is a pop gun, though the ancient and honorable of the earth affirm it to be the crack of doom." I think too many times in the 60s when I wrote this piece, we saw a crack of doom on something of much lesser significance. Take Cuba, for example. Little tiny country, 90 miles off our shores, that had a revolution in which Fidel Castro won. I don't think Castro has had a blameless record. I don't like any kind of dictators around the world, but I don't see where he was any worse than most of the ones, including some that we actually backed with military aid. I suspect that a great many young Americans, if they had been living in Cuba under the Batista regime, this ruthless, corrupt dictator that ruled that little island in cooperation with the American mafia, given that situation, I have the feeling that many idealistic young people in Cuba probably went off in the jungle with Castro to see if they could bring in a better day. I don't know whether they were disappointed or not with what they had wrought, but it was a mistake for the United States to fall into what I called our Castro fixation, the notion that somehow this was a gigantic threat to the security of the United States, to the point where we actually engineered an invasion of Cuba, although it had done nothing against us. President Kennedy bravely took the blame for all of that, although it was planned in the previous administration. But to boycott and embargo this little country for the last half century, I find a classic example of what I've called the crisis mentality. What is the danger in the United States having diplomatic relations with this little island, and even travel and trade relations? Why shouldn't Americans be given the authority to travel to and from Cuba? Why shouldn't our business people have the opportunity to develop trading opportunities there, even investment possibilities? But that's the kind of thing that I regard as an exaggerated reaction to a minor problem. And of course, Vietnam, a little country that was no threat to us. Most Americans wouldn't have ever heard about it had we not put our army in there over a period of about 20 years after backing the French in their effort to reestablish their colonies in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. But our policy towards Vietnam all during the 60s and on through until we finally took our forces out of there after 1973, an action, incidentally, which prompted the Vietnamese to become our friends almost overnight after the death of 58,000 young Americans and an estimated 2 million Vietnamese. But those are the kind of things I was talking about in this article. And I think the crisis mentality is still alive. I conclude on this note. This morning's paper, USA Today, the headline, which is all I'll read, Bush raises specter of World War III if Iran develops nuclear weapons. I hope Iran doesn't develop nuclear weapons. Frankly, I wish nobody had them. But as the possessor of 20,000 of them, we're not on too strong a footing to object to Iran having one, especially since the president, now in the White House, began his term by announcing the axis of evil: Iraq, Iran, North Korea, and then attacked the first country on the list, Iraq. Iran comes up next, and yet this threat that if they should build a nuclear weapon, it means World War III. That's the crisis mentality that worries me. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to thank all of our distinguished panelists, and we'll throw the floor open to anyone who has a question, and please direct them at whomever on the panel you would like. Gentleman in the second row.
Just wait for the microphone.
Oh.
First, I want to pay my respects to Senator, former Senator McGovern. I voted for him. I thought what a terrible travesty it was that people chose Nixon instead of McGovern. Now, after saying that, I must also say I feel the same way about Bush and Gore. We would live in a different world if Gore was elected, I feel. However, my question to Senator McGovern is this. You've lived long enough to see all the errors that our government has made. The quagmire we are now involved in Iraq, and the dangers that we are now facing. And the question that I would like to ask, do you see any resolution of the problems? Is there any answer to how we could possibly get out of Iraq today? And what would be the consequences of many of the choices that we would make? Thank you.
Well, thank you for your kind words. I wrote a little book a little over a year ago, with William Polk, one of our most admirable Middle East experts. And it was entitled Out of Iraq Now, a Practical Plan for Disengagement. And in that book, we call for the withdrawal of U.S. forces within 6 months. That was to have begun in January of last year. So obviously that formula was not heeded. But at least we have some pledges from the presidential contenders that are running now that they're against the war. Some of them voted for the initial resolution. One of those was Hillary Clinton, but she says flat out, if this war is still in progress, if she's elected, she'll terminate it swiftly. And I think that's true. I think it's true with the other contenders. It may be true with some of the Republican contenders, but there's no other way to get out of Iraq other than to resolve to do so. I think a lot of the problem began there when we put our army into that country. It was not a nest of terrorists at that time. They had a dictator like the kind we've dealt with in other parts of the world, but there was no hotbed of terrorism in Iraq. That began after we put our army there, and I don't think it's going to subside until we take it out. I would say this to you. I don't think there's a happy way out of Iraq. As the late Lyndon Johnson says, it's easy to get into a war. It's sure as hell hard to get out. And I think that's true. And I don't think there'll be a happy result if we pull out. There's not a happy result now if we stay in. Sooner or later, we're going to have to turn this country back to the Iraqi people.
Lady in the second row, would you like to ask a question?
The subject for tonight is the America idea.
Mm-hmm.
Should it have been the American ideal? Because there are ideas from America that are not so nice. For instance, corporatism.
Mm-hmm.
And this crisis, capitalism. Could you address that, please?
Yes. Well, the actual phrase, as I mentioned, the American idea, came from the mission statement that the founders wrote. And we did not intend by that phrase a kind of hyper-patriotic boosterism or some, you know, pie-eyed notion of American exceptionalism. The idea of this book is to be not only to celebrate what's good about the country, but also to criticize the country when it goes astray. And I think Senator McGovern's piece is a very good example of many pieces in the book that call into question directions that the country is going in. So I think the American idea is something that also that provides both great opportunity but also grave risk. And we wanted to get at both of those things in the book. Gentleman in the front. Sir, in the blue shirt? Okay.
May I just respectfully correct a misstatement of yours and jokingly suggest that you travel with a fact checker? The most wealthy man in the nation, in the world, is not whom you said, but rather a Spanish-speaking chap who was mentioned either in the Wall Street Journal last week or the LA Times. I'm sorry I can't tell you his name. I had never heard of him.
Yeah, he's a Mexican cement baron. But at the time this was written, and I made no claim that if I did, I was mistaken, that Warren Buffett was ever the wealthy, was even at the time the wealthiest person in the world. I believe that belongs to a Middle Eastern royal of some description. But he was at the time the American who, with Bill Gates on a sort of day-to-day basis, vied for being the wealthiest American.
The question I had was, considering the fact that America had become from sea to shining sea, and that one of your contributors, a very dear friend of mine who taught me poetry at Amherst, Robert Frost, is a San Franciscan himself, why was the Atlantic Monthly called the Atlantic instead of the Atlantic Pacific Monthly?
Well, the Atlantic was named by Oliver Wendell Holmes, and it was just the Atlantic Monthly was a title that sort of struck a euphonious chord with all the other co-founders of the magazine. I think what they were trying to suggest is two things by the title. One is that it was kind of a tip of the hat to their European intellectual ancestors, but it was also a declaration of independence from those same European ties. So the Atlantic was a way of in a way, suggesting both an acknowledgement of the traditions that Europe had provided them with, but also a declaration that they were going to forge their own path.
My question's for Walter Kern. I thoroughly enjoy Up in the Air every time I read it.
And thanks.
I would like to know if you interviewed Warren Buffett and if you suspect he ever employs a ghostwriter.
Well, this is interesting. One of the specialties of magazine writers when approaching people of great fame or fortune who won't speak to them is to consider them as an idea and therefore write about them through their writings, through their public performances. And that's what I had to do because Warren Buffett would not talk to me. He's famously shy with the press, famously unwilling to promote himself in what would generally be sort of pop culture media circles. So it forced me in a way to consider him from a distance, which I felt was actually the fruitful approach with him, because it was seeing him as a figure, as you and I might see him, as you and I might encounter him in our impressions of him through the press, or if we were shareholders of his company, that I thought he was best seen. Most people who'd written about Warren Buffett up to this point wanted to know how he got so damn rich. What was his system? And how can I do it too? And the answer to those questions were very simple. Buy companies that make a profit, buy more of them when their prices go down, and never let go of them. That part was boring. You know, if I wanted to interview Warren Buffett and find out how he get rich, I already knew the answer, and it was a boring answer. But if I wanted to understand how Warren Buffett, one of the richest people in the world, and at the time perhaps the richest man on American soil on any given day, had endeared himself. I mean, don't we hate the rich? I mean, come on. Hadn't the American capitalist up until quite recently been the mustachioed man in the top hat who, you know, walked with his cane and stepped over the bodies of the poor people on the street? How had this average American who of such incredible wealth become our uncle, the guy down the street, you know, and he did it in a way that was both true to his real character, which was to be very smart, modest, steadfast, sort of cunning in a charming way, and he did it also in a conscious way, like a writer does. He found a vehicle to express himself, and he, in a very premeditated way, came up with Warren Buffett, the character, just like Mark Twain took a man named Samuel Clemens, who was a little kid who grew up on the prairie, and turned him into a performer. And that's the way I treated him, and that's partly because he would not speak to me.
I'm going to break the rules and ask two questions, one of Mr. Wilson and one of the senator. The first of Mr. Wilson, I'll give you my questions and listen, is I wondered whether in your studies, whether the police officers developed a sense of community and responsibility for their communities with the assigned community policing. And the question I have for the senator is, if you were president today, who would you appoint as Secretary of State to try and reestablish diplomatic discussions with foreign countries?
One of the things that happened with the Foot Patrol Project in Newark was that the police officers became very close to the communities. That's a matter of some considerable interest to me because I've long been an advocate of community-oriented policing to get officers out of their cars and to get them in touch with people to find out what people want in the neighborhoods. And often what they want is something the police can't do for them. The police and the neighbors have to work with other city agencies and county agencies to bring it about. Unfortunately, community-oriented policing is very difficult to do. And the reason it's difficult to do is that the higher-ranking police authorities are opposed to it. And they're opposed to it because if officers are working with the community, the higher-ranking authorities worry that, A, they may be corrupted, B, they may become unfair, and C, the higher-ranking authorities might not be able to control them. So this struggle to bring about community-oriented policing as one of the aspects of dealing with public order is an uphill struggle, but we've made progress. Today in California, there is a prize given every year to a police department that has shown the most progress in community-oriented policing, and it's called the James Q. Wilson Award. I say that not to draw attention to myself. In fact, I'm not even quite confident that the people who won the award and entirely deserve it, but to suggest that the police are aware that this is important, and as a consequence, higher-ranking police authorities have begun to move in this direction to a greater degree than was the case 10 or 20 years ago when I first began arguing for it.
Well, if I were president and had to name a Secretary of State, one that comes to mind is Lee Hamilton. He's a former chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Now with the Wilson Quarterly Foundation in Washington. He was also the co-chairman of the commission with Jim Baker, President Bush Sr.'s Secretary of State, that came up with a rather thoughtful report on what we should do with Iraq from here on out. Lee Hamilton is a thoughtful man. He would tend to reduce crises wherever possible, not necessarily with military action, but by diplomacy and other means. But I think he'd be a good candidate for that. If I wanted to really be bold and maybe a little more imaginative, and he would take the job, I might appoint our former president, Bell. He's so highly regarded around the world. If you could take a poll today internationally of the entire world as to what man is most admired, I think he might win. And I think he learned in the time he was in the White House how to talk with other countries and how to deal with the Congress, the business community, and other groups. So he might be a good candidate. I have the feeling that Hillary may have a post in mind for him if she should win the presidency.
We have time for one more question. Gentleman in the back.
Hi. Senator McGovern, you're the first person I ever voted for in the presidential election, so I'm proud of saying that. My question is what coming out of a very frightened position about today, I guess, in terms of what is an American idea today when we have so many Americans finding their facts from Fox News and we have reality shows, and the attention of Americans seems to be going all over the place and to these minor skirmishes on street corners where it's front page news because an ambulance does something, or in this country, somebody went over a waterfall in a bus or something, and not on healthcare and not on education. What's going on and what are the American ideas today?
Is this direct?
This is to whoever can help.
Oh, excellent. Anybody want to start on that?
Let me just say, I should make clear, all of my life since I was a youngster, I have thought the United States was the greatest country on earth. I still do. We have to be great because we make these horrendous blunders, and yet we survive. So we must have a pretty good constitution and a pretty good system. I used to tell my daughters, I know you're discouraged about Vietnam, but just remember this, it's such an obvious blunder to everybody now, we'll never go down that road again. And here we are floundering around in a similar situation Iraq. I think things like that have greatly damaged the standing of the United States in the world. I can go on believing, as I do, that this is the greatest country on earth, but all the surveys that I've seen indicate that America has slid precipitously in the last few years in the eyes of the rest of the world, and maybe even in the eyes of our own people. So we have some repair work to do. We have some obligations of a serious nature to bring our standing up, and it means a different foreign policy is long overdue. After the 1940 election, that was the year I was a senior in high school, I was for Wilkie. I grew up in a Republican family, I should tell you. My mother and dad lived and died as Republicans, but not the kind that are running this country today. My dad thought that a balanced budget was desirable. It's the first time in our history, 200-year history, we have an administration that, while taking us into war, reduced taxes at the same time. That's never happened before, always in the past. We raised taxes in World War II, the last war I've believed in. We had an excess profits tax to redeem profits that were considered excessive in the defense industries. But at the end of that campaign, President Roosevelt, who admired Wendell Willkie, asked him if he would make a trip around the world and report back how the United States was perceived in different parts of the world. Willkie did that and wrote a little book when he came back called One World, the most published book in World War II. And in that book, Willkie said everywhere we went, in Europe, in Latin America, in Asia, in Africa, in the Middle East, we found that the greatest source of American power and influence in the world was the attitude of confidence and goodwill that people everywhere extended to America and our leaders. I think we've lost that standing. I don't think you'd find that on a globe-circling tour today. So we have a lot of repair work to do in the years ahead.
I want to thank our very distinguished panelists tonight. And Robert, thank you so much for bringing this together, and the Atlantic Monthly for making this possible, and the Library Foundation. Our panelists will be in the lobby signing copies of their essays in The American Idea, and we'll see you there. Thank you so much for coming.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakci Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC, 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. A Loud theme composed by Larry Karish.